Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Start off with a little funny anecdote. Today I was on the phone with Kaiser, and I spent a lot of time in my life on hold. I'm sure you do as well. Various institutions, various phone mail systems. When I deal with insurance companies in general, I find them to be the most deliberately torturous companies. And I think the idea is they're trying to force me to use their online stuff. A long time ago, children, once upon a time, there was this thing called hold. And when you were on hold, you really weren't sure whether the call had dropped. Now, this is back in the days of landlines, so calls didn't drop that often, but sometimes they did, particularly when they were switching you from one place to another. So you'd be on hold for a while, and you'd wonder if the call had dropped, and you had no way of knowing. It was very suspenseful. You weren't sure if you were wasting your time. Well, along came the concept of a beep. Every 30 seconds or so, it would kind of ping you, beep, and then 30 seconds later, beep, so you knew that you were still on the line, still waiting for someone to get to you. And then came along hold music. Ah, let's play some nice, relaxing music for the people while they wait. And that was okay, although the tapes on the hold music tended to be actual plastic, and they would stretch, and the sound could get pretty weird sometimes, but at least it was music of a sort, and it told you you were still waiting. Sometime in the last two decades, I'd say about, well, I'm not really sure, because I used to have minions who spent most of the time on hold with insurance companies. Now I'm kind of doing that myself, but it changed, and now you listen to ads and announcements, and they'll start you off with a little bit of music. Kaiser is terrible, and I suffered today with this, but I get the same thing from any insurance company when I'm calling to do an authorization, try to get an approval for a procedure. It's just part of the purgatory of being a doctor. So music for 20 or 30 seconds, then little message, all workers are busy helping others, continue to hold. 20 seconds, more music, different music, I might add. Then a notification that I could press 9 to make an appointment for my COVID vaccine if I qualified. Obviously haven't updated it lately, guys. Then music for 15 seconds. Then a reminder that I could do whatever it is that I thought I wanted to do online at the website. Except, of course, I couldn't, or I wouldn't have put myself through this. Then 10 seconds of music. Is it me, or do the music intervals get shorter? Now, I've learned not to try to keep working, because whenever the voice comes on, I break away from my concentration because I think it might actually be a human voice. And they change voices, male to female, so you can't just wait. And it's very stressful to try to actually concentrate and then be broken every 15 seconds from your concentration. That, my friends, is scientifically proven to raise your blood pressure. So I have learned, and I want to share with you my learning. I have a suggestion. Use the time as a breath trainer. We're all too stressed and hyped up. So use that time to just breathe in and out slowly. Don't try to do anything else except count the seconds. And just breathe in for 4, 5, or 6 seconds through your nose. Get your lungs really full, and then just let the air fall out of your body through your puckered lips, and for another 4 to 6 seconds. Try to make it the same interval each time. According to research, the sweet spot is at 5 seconds or 6 10-second in and out breaths per minute. That's almost like a code input to your brain to cause your vagus nerve and your parasympathetic response to increase. So just keep breathing in and out. You're going to raise your sympathetic tone. You're going to lower your fight or flight. You're going to reduce your stress. And the more time you spend in a day breathing like this, the better off you are. And your boss can't really pester you. What's going on? I'm on hold. Can't you work while you're on hold? Not really, because they keep talking every 10 seconds. Okay. Assuming that your boss is actually hovering over you, which, of course, nowadays isn't all that common. This improves your functioning. It also reduces pain. Your own pain receptors will calm down, and that little headache you've got, it'll probably get less painful. That neck pain, you could sit up straight while you breathe. Breathe with your diaphragm in your belly. Who's watching? So that's a good time to practice belly breathing. And then when you finally get to a human, you'll be in a completely different state of mind. Remember, the human you're talking to has been talking to annoyed people for hours. So be nice. Use their name. They always give it to you. Make a joke or two and thank them. This also works for going through outgoing voicemail messages. If Verizon tells me one more time that I could also send a fax, yeah, I know, except it's a cell phone. But there you go. Breathe. Smile. You'll live longer and healthier. So our first story for tonight is a really exciting one. A discovery about one health product that I've been wanting for quite some time, omega-3 fatty acids. I first of all want to remind you what that is. These are polyunsaturated acids, which means they have lots of double bonds, multiple double bonds. And double bonds provide structure to a fatty acid that causes it to twist on itself. It makes it a very different molecule. The more polyunsaturated fatty acids that you have in your cell walls, the healthier they are. It's been shown in the brain that it actually makes the synapses work better and it keeps the nerves healthier. These are wonderful, wonderful things. They're found in high levels in fish and in many plants. You can get omega-3s from krill or algae. You can get them from, as I said, many plants. And our diets, a lot of our food, particularly fast food and processed foods, they don't use omega-3s because omega-3s go bad. They go rancid more quickly. They have to be protected from oxidation. And this oxidation can actually be weaponized. So before we go any further, I want to emphasize we're talking about healthy fats here. We're talking about something that has anti-inflammatory benefit. We're talking about things that in healthy and even unhealthy human bodies are very beneficial if they haven't gone off. So if you're using capsules for your fatty acids once a month, you're going to want to pinprick that capsule and you're going to want to put one drop on your tongue. You can have an Altoids ready, you know, just if you don't like the taste of fish. But you want to make sure that that doesn't have the taste of rancid or old walnuts. It's a bitter taste. This should taste fishy, but it shouldn't taste bitter. If it's bitter, it's oxidized and it's no longer healthy. Another thing about these omega-3s is that you cannot cook with them and that destroys them. So you can add them to food as long as the food is not steaming. So if you want to stir liquid omegas into a soup or use it or into a salad dressing, perfect. But wait till the soup cools down to mouth temperature before you do that. Now, I use liquid omegas so that when that rancid taste starts, I'm going to know it right away. And that way I don't run into this problem. In this latest study, however, researchers found that there is a remarkable anti-tumor effect to one of the common omega-3 fatty acids, and that's DHA. So in this study, they were looking at cancer cells, and they were doing both cancer cells in the lab and in mice with cancer, and they saw the same results. Cancer cells, if they're in the middle of a tumor, the environment in there is very acidic because a lot of the cancer cells are acting like bacteria, and they're burning glucose, but they're creating acid as they do it, just like lactic acid, right? When you get lactic acid in your muscles, that means that you've surpassed your aerobic threshold, you're out of oxygen, so your body switches to anaerobic metabolism, which is more wasteful, poorer fuel economy, but at least it provides energy. Now, in tumors, they're running on glycolysis all the time. The center gets really acidic. So the cancer cells start absorbing fatty acids to use as food because it's so acid they can't do glycolysis anymore. If you have high levels of these omega-3 fatty acids or certain omega-6s, but mostly we're talking about omega-3 here, you get a chemical reaction inside the cancer cells called ferroptosis. This is under an ambient acidic condition. So if the atmosphere is acidic in that center of that tumor, the omega-3s are going to kill the tumor cells. It's going to cause them to die. The peroxidation, essentially what happens is that you have to buffer it. You have to buffer it from the acid. And there's only so much buffer in those poor little cancer cells in their lipid droplets. And when you saturate them with fatty acid, they're pigs, they're little piggies, so they eat it all up. But then they can't use it. It goes bad inside them and kills them. And it's directly in proportion to the number of double bonds, which is what makes DHA, which has more double bonds, the best one for doing this. Now, they compared this in mice. They were looking at, well, is this better than the Mediterranean diet, which, as you know, has a lot of olive oil in it? Olive oil is a monounsaturated fatty acid, and it has been associated with lower cancer risk, but that was completely surpassed by the DHA, which is a component in lots of fish oil. If you extrapolate from these cancer mice and look at the growth of their tumors, it was drastically slowed down in the mice. And so we know this is a thing. And there are also additional compounds that are now being studied called diglycerol acyl transferase inhibitors. Only thing to know about that is that that's something it's safe to take in healthy human cells, but it amplifies the benefit of the PUFA-rich diet, polyunsaturated fatty acid-rich diet, is sometimes called PUFA. Bottom line, about 500 milligrams of DHA a day is going to be one of the best things you can possibly do for a solid growth tumor. Because it's food, yes, it's food, then the oncologist probably won't object. And I plan to, I may have to actually pay for this article, but I may have to pay for this so that I can hand it to my oncologist colleagues so that they stop telling my patients not to take omega-3 fatty acids because the anti-inflammatory effect might interfere with their chemo. This stuff is going to make their chemo work better. So now, some more good news. Just came out of the New England Journal of Medicine, latest issue. It's a study about COVID vaccines in pregnant women. So obviously we've had the vaccine since January, and people started getting it mostly in February and March, although healthcare workers were getting it in December. So we have a few cases there. We don't have a lot of babies born yet, is my point. However, we do have a lot of data on pregnancy. I had this discussion on email last week with someone, and the discussion went, my daughter is worried about getting the vaccine because she's planning on seeking pregnancy. So I just want to speak to that fear. If you are pregnant, or if you're thinking about getting pregnant and you're holding off on getting the vaccine, in my opinion, that's a poor decision, because we know from good solid data in a lot of people that pregnant women were at much greater risk than same age, equally healthy or unhealthy non-pregnant women for severe COVID infection, severe disease after COVID. In other words, severe means intensive care unit, ventilator, and maybe death. If you have coexisting illnesses like diabetes or hypertension, you were at even greater risk. But just normal, healthy 30-year-old women who were pregnant had a higher risk of dying, and they also had a much greater risk of pregnancy complications, especially preterm birth, C-section, and preeclampsia, which can cause seizures. These happen at a higher level when you have COVID infection during pregnancy. So there's the risk on one side of the scale. I want you to imagine a balance scale, the old-fashioned kind with, you know, the lady holding up the scale, symbolizing justice. Well, we're going to put that data on one side of the scale. And now we're going to put this recently published in the New England Journal. Shima Bukuru is the lead author. And in this study, they went back over all of the data from VSafe. Now, VSafe, when you got your vaccine, you were invited to enroll in VSafe. I, of course, did. It's a smartphone-based surveillance system from the CDC, and it would send you a text first every week, and then every couple of weeks, and then every month. I guess I'm on the quarterly now, because it's been 2 months since I've gotten a text, but I presume that they will ping me later on. Anything bad happened to you yet? How are you feeling? So it just wants data. If you were pregnant, you could check a box and you would be able to enroll in the VSafe pregnancy registry. And if you were of pregnancy age, every time they pinged you, they asked you if you'd gotten pregnant. Participants from 16 to 54 were in this study. There were 35,000 of them. These were women who identified as pregnant. So that was one set. They also had the VSafe group. Now, unfortunately, and this makes me sad, only 5% enrolled in the VSafe. We have over 100,000 pregnant women who got the vaccine, but we don't have data on most of them because they didn't enroll. So about half of them got Pfizer and about half of them got Moderna. This is all the mRNA vaccines, the ones that we had first. Among those who got vaccines, about 28% received their vaccine in the first trimester, 43% in the second trimester, and 25% in the third trimester. And only the third trimester group has delivered. We have 827 women who completed their pregnancy. The rates of miscarriage were exactly the same as similar cohorts, same ages, health status, you know, unknown because we're talking population here. So there's no increase relative to the general population risk by age. Stillborn was the same, well within the range we would expect for healthy pregnancies. 86% resulted in a live birth. Preterm birth was 9%, same as we'd expect. Small size for gestational age or SGA, 3%. And congenital anomalies were 2%, which is actually a little bit on the low side, although still within the range that we would expect just basically on really good statistics because we track the stuff in the population. So we have really good numbers. They had the same number of side effects and the same kind of side effects as the non-pregnant women who got the vaccine. We have only a small number of live births. There's nothing about those babies that's raising any red flags. But it is fair to say that we don't know that. I would say, however, if you're a healthy young woman and you are seeking pregnancy, you should go and seek the vaccine first. It's pretty clear that the risk of pregnancy when you might get COVID, when you might get the Delta virus sneaking up on you or the Delta variant sneaking up on you, that's a bigger risk than the vaccine. And I know you're worried about your baby, but let me tell you, you should be worried about your baby when you get COVID and you're pregnant, because that is much worse for that developing fetus. That illness is bad. We don't have data on the COVID babies either, but I can tell you that high fever is not good for the developing fetal brain. Neither are those inflammatory things. And the fact that there's increased stillbirths and increased preterm births tells you that it is having a negative effect on the pregnancy. So please think about this. Think about that lady with the scale and recognize that the scale is really kind of tipped, as this study suggests, in the direction of doing something. Our next story is about something that it's quite possible you never heard of, a compound in your body called nitric oxide. And one of the reasons you haven't heard about it is that it's created and destroyed locally throughout the body, and it's very short-lived. So it's only been relatively recently that we've even acknowledged its supreme importance as a signaler. Robert Fuchsgott, Louis Ignaro, and Fareed Murad got a Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1998 for their discovery in nitric oxide's role as a signaling molecule. That means basically when I was in medical school, I was not even taught about nitric oxide because it was still being researched. Most people, if you do know anything about it, think about it as associated with blood vessels. It's made by the lining of the blood vessels, and we're going to get into that in just a moment. But it's also made by cells within the immune system. This stuff is amazing. It reduces the thickness of the inflammatory cells in plaque. It actually makes the endothelium, that's the cells lining all of your blood vessels, work better. It allows them to induce vasodilation. You've heard of white coat hypertension? Well, white coat hypertension is basically when you have adrenaline on board. What's normally supposed to happen is you get a burst of adrenaline and it kicks up your nitric oxide and you get a bump in your blood pressure and then it normalizes. White coat hypertension and also erectile dysfunction are two very important nitric oxide dependent things that go wrong early in people who 5 to 15 years later are going to develop hypertension. More stuff. It actually decreases cholesterol, decreases triglycerides. If you have peripheral artery disease, it increases your walking distance because it opens up the blood vessels. If you have interstitial cystitis, it reduces pain. It drops your blood pressure. I use some of the things we're about to talk about all the time in blood pressure patients, and often I can get them off their meds. It actually decreases your postoperative length of stay. It increases human growth hormone, exercise tolerance, improves insulin sensitivity, improves cell-mediated immunity, improves your pituitary function, reduces blood clots and stroke risk. It helps with osteoporosis, improves irritable bowel syndrome, and improves memory. All right, how am I going to get me some of this? This sounds pretty good. Well, I hope you're sold, and let's talk about how you can increase it. For one thing, your microbiome, assuming it's healthy, is able to make nitrate in your foods turn into nitrite and then into nitric oxide. So your microbiome can do this. And this happens both in your mouth and in the gut. You can also make it in the bloodstream, in those endothelial cells, with a compound, an amino acid called arginine. We can eat or supplement, well, L-arginine is in meat, it's in certain plants. You can also use L-arginine as a supplement. Inside the bloodstream, there's an enzyme called nitric oxide synthase, which breaks down arginine and turns it into nitric oxide. And this is how the endothelium does it. This is how your blood vessels do it. So, like I said, if you don't have enough, you've got hypertension. So, if you've got hypertension, take more. Another thing to understand about that endothelium is when it's healthy, it lies flat like little plates. It's smooth and it's like a nonstick surface. Think Teflon, except healthier. An unhealthy endothelium is like Velcro. It's going to pick up lint, it grabs white blood cells, it platelets stick to it, and it's pro-coagulant. So if you can increase nitric oxide, you actually get the endothelium back to the healthier shape, and you restore a compound called the glycocalyx, which is actually sort of a lubricant lining the inside of your blood vessels that is very, very dynamic and goes up and down with meals. In fact, we say that anytime you eat, your blood vessels, your glycocalyx is degraded a little bit, and then it comes back, rebuilds itself very quickly over a couple of hours. So I'm going to recommend that you think about a couple of foods, and one of them is beets. Beets are very high in nitrates, and another one is arugula, which is a salad green, and it has the highest nitrate concentration. So if you want the biggest bang for your heart healthy buck, you could slice up some beets, cooked beets, I would recommend, and drop them on a bed of arugula and maybe put some goat cheese on top. If you're following the DASH diet, which is the initials are diet for reducing hypertension, that diet is 6 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, you'll be getting about at least 1,200 milligrams of nitrates a day. So you want to have that good bacteria. One tip, stop using antibacterial mouthwashes. They kill off those bacteria in the mouth that start the process of converting nitrate to nitrite. Go ahead and brush, go ahead and floss, but lose the Listerine. Other things that can suppress the conversion are proton pump inhibitors, my favorite Bête Noire. Now, if you're going to take arginine, a couple words of caution, you're going to need between 2,000 and 4,000 milligrams of it. You might want to get a combo product that contains citrulline. I'm beginning to see some research that says that the combination of those two together works better. This is preliminary. I'm not completely persuaded. I get good results with L-arginine alone. But, you know, if you have the option, you might consider getting the two of them. And one precaution, if you suffer from herpes, oral herpes or genital, L-arginine can actually cause a flare. So you're going to want to take about 1,000 milligrams of lysine some other time during the day, not with the L-arginine because they'll cancel each other out. I hope you're seeing that healthy diet can make a huge difference. And there's all sorts of mechanisms by which what we put in our mouth affects our body in a myriad of ways. Let's take a moment to move to emails. This was sent to AskDrDawn.com. This comes from Sybil in SoCal. Dear Dr. Dawn, in December 2020, my ferritin level was low, 18 nanograms per ml. I took an iron supplement, retested in June, and the level was normal at 27. All my other iron levels were normal. My doctor did not tell me how much iron I should take, so I just took 10 milligrams of liquid iron ferrous bisglycinate every day for about 3 months, then every other day until now. I'm not sure if I should continue to take iron as a 65-year-old vegan on a daily basis. Two well-known vegan doctors are against taking any iron supplements. Dr. Barnard thinks it can contribute to Alzheimer's. What's your opinion? Should I continue to take an iron supplement? And if so, how much? How often? I did take the iron with vitamin C, and I eat a good amount of iron-containing vegetables with vitamin C. I know all about heme and non-heme kinds of food. A functional medicine pharmacist, with whom I don't always agree, Ben Fuchs, advises to take lecithin. He claims it's good for the brain. Do you think it's a good idea? Thanks so much. Well, first of all, Sybil, you were never anemic, and your red blood cell mass, I'm assuming, remained normocytic. In other words, your red blood cells were not shrinking. That's when I treat. I don't treat a lab value, ferritin. Ferritin is a storage form of iron, but it can go up when you're inflamed, so it makes it fairly unreliable. In your case, it was low, but that may just mean that you have very low inflammation. I don't really think we need to treat low ferritin in individuals, and I think it's overkill. And I also want to point out that iron in any form is pro-inflammatory. And that's probably where this connection to Alzheimer's is coming in, is that inflammation is associated with Alzheimer's. And I've certainly read all of the work by Dr. Bredesen, and I think he has a point in his book, The End of Alzheimer's, that what you really want to avoid is anything inflammatory. Until we have better data, that would include iron. So my thought is you want to eat those high iron foods, perhaps mixing them with acid at the time. So I would start doing lemon zest, which also has some substantial health benefits because of the limonene. So organic lemons only, but I don't think I need to tell you that. But maybe your cooked spinach, high in iron, a little lemon zest. Maybe think about breaking up the cooked spinach by pureeing it and then putting the lemon zest on it or lemon juice to improve the bioavailability of the iron. And yeah, you're fine. The thing to really monitor is the size of the red blood cells. They'll shrink first before you get anemic. And if that's going on, then yeah, let's get you on some iron should you take a high dose at longer intervals or a small dose every day at shorter intervals? I just can't say. But I would guess that probably a high dose at longer intervals is less healthy than a small dose all the time, just based on what we were talking about earlier with the DHA and the cancer cells, that when you blast, you might cross some kind of threshold that you don't know about into inflammation. Whereas a little bit all the time, yeah, I think we're probably adapted to handle that. Our next story is about vitamin D. There's actually kind of a racial justice thread to this story because we have really good data from our recent COVID epidemic about how low vitamin D was a risk factor for bad COVID, whether you were black, brown, white, or purple. In fact, you all turned purple if you got bad COVID. And low vitamin D levels at admission were actually a predictor. Now, the data is very messy about whether you could give people vitamin D supplement when they hit the ER and improve their survival. But that's kind of beside the point, in my opinion. What we know is that, I've seen this in my population for many years, the browner your skin, the lower your vitamin D level in most cases. You have melanin. Melanin prevents the ultraviolet from getting to the precursor to vitamin D in the skin and converting it literally with the mechanical effect of ultraviolet light, like developing film, taking a photograph. Your skin changes the molecule, and that new molecule then is absorbed into the system. It goes first to the liver, where it's transformed again, and then to the kidney, where it's transformed a third time. It's crazy. It's as complicated as the parasite cycle. This is the journey of vitamin D, which is not a vitamin. It's a hormone. That's why it has such broad effects throughout the body. But among those broad effects, you could almost consider this an immune system signaling hormone. That's how much it has to do with the immune system. So if you have low levels of it, you have more inflammation. If you have more inflammation, when COVID walks through the door, you're going to get sicker. That's just how this works. And it showed, you know, we see it. We see it in the death rates. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, blacks are only 13% of the U.S. population. Almost 60% of deaths come in counties with higher black populations. In Chicago, African Americans died at 6 times. That's 600% the rates of white Chicagoans. That's just in one city. Same thing in LA. So what's up? Well, part of it's vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency and COVID risk is one of the contributing factors. Yeah, you know, it's going to take a while to fix income inequality and housing inequality and all of the other problems in our society. But we could make a real big difference by just going after vitamin D in the economically disadvantaged populations. There's a Dr. Red Cross. Red Cross, what a name, right, for a doctor? And he's part of the Organic and Natural Health Association. And they're working very hard doing outreach in African and Native American communities and Hispanic communities to help them understand the importance of getting their vitamin D levels up. Now, he thinks the vitamin D should be between 40 and 60, and I completely agree. I've been checking it for over a decade in every physical I do, and I get people on supplements until it's up in that range. It takes months and months to get it to come up, and it's very safe to take as much as 5,000 units a day for indefinite periods of time. I monitor the levels, as I said, annually, and I've never had a single patient who is taking 5,000 get above 100, which is where I draw a line and say, okay, we got to reduce the dose. Now, that's clinical experience. It's not experimental. And there's certainly no placebo. It's observational, but it's still pretty good data. And I'm solidly convinced that you can't hurt yourself with a vitamin D level of 60. And by the way, if you have autoimmune disease, 60 is your floor and 80 is your ceiling, because it makes a huge difference in autoimmune disease in my clinical experience. also really helps with pain, inflammation in general, but especially pain. Now, lab tests are expensive. The organization I just talked about, the Organic and Natural Health Association, has got a kit that you can order. And if you don't have insurance or you have a high deductible, you might consider doing this. It's a finger stick blood spot check. Also, people can check their hemoglobin A1C and C-reactive protein and their omega-3 index to see whether they're in the low cancer zone. We talked about that earlier this program. And you can also get a TSH off of this finger stick kit. Now, I'm sure that all costs more, but basically it's a lab test at $65, and you can check your vitamin D once a year and get it up to that range and then stay on the dose that got you there. I love vitamin D. I think it's the forgotten hormone. And now that I have solid data that it actually slows down the growth of cancer, I'm going to even get even higher on my vitamin D hobby horse and say this is one of the critical things that we all should be doing, is making sure our vitamin D level is where it should be. All right, we're going to spend the last part of the program talking about CRISPR, one of my favorite topics. But first, a little review. CRISPR, what is that? Is that something for vegetables? Well, in this case, it's CRISPR, and it stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. Ah, what's that? Well, the story starts about 10 years ago when bacteria were found to have areas of non-coding DNA, these short 20 nucleotide sequences that repeatedly were there in the bacterial genome, but they never made any proteins or appeared to do anything. They were just repeating forward and backwards in a so-called palindrome. A palindrome is where the phrase is spelled forward and then backward. So a classic example is, Madam, I'm Adam. And that is a mirror image. It works either way. What were these things? It was such an oddity. And it sort of sat there in, you know, the cabinet of curiosities of bacterial oddities for a long time. But it turned out that they were part of the bacterial immune system. They were kind of recognition site for viruses that attack bacteria, very much like our own antibodies. So once the bacteria in question was attacked, it saved a short segment of the sequence of the virus so it could recognize it and destroy it by cutting up the DNA or the RNA of the virus with a targeted set of molecular scissors. That's the CRISPR, the molecular scissors. Now, in 2013, Charpentier and Doudna, two women scientists, I have to throw that in, turned this from a scientific curiosity into a tool. They created a complex molecule using CRISPR and something called Cas9. It was a perfect way to target a DNA sequence in any existing life form. Let me say that again. Any existing life form. We don't think of viruses as alive. I'm not sure it works in viruses, but it works in bacteria, fungi, any plant, and any animal, anywhere in the animal kingdom. You go after a sequence. I always think of it like taking, like in the old movies when they got the bloodhounds and they take the handkerchief and they let the bloodhound smell it and the bloodhound starts barking and runs off. Well, CRISPR's like that. You give it its target and it goes into the cell and it goes into the DNA and it finds the sequence and it cuts it. And then the Cas9 comes in and replaces it with another sequence that you've previously made in the lab and loaded into the Cas9. So the old CRISPR was just the cutting tool, but the Cas9 actually allows you to use it as a cut and paste tool. Gene editing, and we build the DNA, but couldn't get it into the right place. Gene editing had been really hard, and we'd had lots of failures trying to fix genetic diseases. We were effectively throwing paint at a wall and hoping to get results. Well, we now had masking tape and a set of brushes, and we could get precise, reproducible results. Of course, a tool that powerful can be used for good, but it can also be abused. And it wasn't long before scientists in China started monkeying around with human DNA and actually used in vitro fertilization to change eggs and implant those fertilized eggs. And those fertilized eggs actually grew up into children. We sure hope they grow up healthy and strong and without problems, because we got a 25-year experiment here, and it takes sometimes a long time to figure stuff out. So it's Pandora's box. Got that. But today I'm going to discuss two new exciting ways that CRISPR is changing biological science. Regular listeners will have heard me talk about epigenetics, but I'm going to just take a moment. If you have heard it, you're not quite sure what it is, think about it this way. Your DNA is like an encyclopedia. It's printed, and so if you were going to get in there with CRISPR, you'd actually be taking, well, essentially an X-Acto knife and cutting out a word and pasting another word into an article about, oh, I don't know, Kaiser Wilhelm or something, right? That's CRISPR. But epigenetics is more like taking a chapter and putting paperclips on the pages so that they don't open, so it can't be read. You can turn on and you can turn off DNA with epigenetic changes. And the two main epigenetic changes that we're going to be talking about here are methylation and histone tagging, histone acetylation. First of all, visualize a long string of letters. Those letters would be A, T, G, and C over and over again in all kinds of different combinations. Sometimes that DNA is going to code for a protein. Sometimes that DNA is going to code for a messenger RNA that doesn't turn into a protein, but instead turns off other messenger RNA. Sometimes it's going to code for a messenger RNA that does something else. Turns out that the non-coding parts of the genome that we thought were junk are hugely important. But that's where a lot of the methylation happens, is on that non-coding DNA. So just a carbon and three hydrogens sitting on the right spot can make sure that those pages, it acts as a paperclip, those pages never get read. On the other hand, taking methylation, putting it on another spot, ensures like a big flag that that DNA is going to get read. And we are still learning the nuances of this. But what CRISPR has allowed us to do is study this at a much, much deeper level. This was published in April in the journal Cell, but I've been kind of waiting to have time to talk about it. Researchers at UCSF and the Whitehead Institute created another CRISPR-based tool. They're calling it CRISPR-Off. It allows scientists to switch off almost any gene in the human cell so that they can study it, but they don't create a mutation. It's an on-off switch, so they can later erase that change. So the researchers are aware that we need to figure out the epigenome, but they're also looking at the epigenome as a better way to make changes. Let's say you have Huntington disease, which is a disease where you make the wrong protein. I talked a couple of weeks ago, about a new drug for Huntington's, which didn't work because it blocked all of the Huntington's protein, not just the bad copy, but the good copy. And so it didn't help the patients. But imagine you could just go in there, target the bad copy, and, well, methylate it to silence that gene. You'd essentially be CRISPRing the methylation. And that's what CRISPR-Off does. It doesn't alter the DNA sequence, it alters the methylation, so it can turn a gene off. So it just sticks it on, and it acts on the epigenome. They made CRISPR-Off, and they shortly thereafter made CRISPR-On. And they've been able to show that what we thought we knew about methylation, which is that only genes that have a CPG island, in other words, a series of CG, 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 CGs. Oh, wait, a palindromic repetitive. No, it's not palindromic, but it's a repetitive segment. Anyway, that's on there. That's where the methylation goes. That's the start or the stop signal. Well, it turns out that CRISPR-Off works on other genes that don't have that, and the researchers themselves don't even know how it works. But when you turn off a gene with CRISPR-Off, that gene is also turned off in the descendants of the cell, up to 450 generations, which is as long as they took it. well, that's great if it's a hereditary disease. And they also found that when they messed with stem cells, the transition from stem cell to differentiated adult cell, there's a lot of epigenetic change going on there. But the CRISPR-off marks stayed there, at least in a significant fraction of cells. So you might only have to do this once, and it wouldn't wear off very quickly. We might be able to fix certain things like Marfan syndrome, a connective tissue disease that's thought to have affected Abraham Lincoln. This is like really, really amazing stuff. And it's a lot more benign because it's reversible. And honest to God, when you're messing around with genes, you can pretty much count on unintended consequences. And given that you can count on not entirely knowing what you're doing, you probably want to have a control Z to go back and undo it. So you can think of CRISPR-off as control X, and you can think of CRISPR-on as control Z. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. I can fix it. It's enormously exciting. The other thing that CRISPR is helping us do is actually learn to speak epigenetics. These non-coding RNA, I mentioned that they have different purposes. One of the purposes is to turn off DNA that's already been transcribed into mRNA rather than letting that mRNA be transcribed. Remember, that's a single strand. It's the negative to that single strand. So it's a modulator. So you can turn on genes, make a lot of something, and then have a timer. So after 5 hours of making a lot of something, you suddenly start making this anti-mRNA, and that cleans out what you made. It turns it off and basically gets it out of the cell so it stops being transcribed. It also turns out that, as I said, the start and the stop signals for transcription are non-coding. And the mRNA, in many of the cases, this is non-coding, so it's not mRNA, it's microRNA. It can act as a start signal itself. How do you study this? Well, you want to take CRISPR. You want to suppress our RNA, this signal RNA. You want to suppress it and see what happens. They used something called the CRISPR-I non-coding library, which targets all of these RNA genes that are controlling RNAs. And they used 7 different cell lines, and they essentially turned stuff off. What they found was fascinating. You know, the start signal was often very, very far from the actual protein it coded. Now, maybe when the DNA is folded up, it's close, but that's counterintuitive. While they have all of these CRISPR anti-signal RNAs, they're very, very specific. So most of the cells that they looked at had a completely different set of signals. So that tells us that it's in very, very elaborate, nuanced kind of language. I think the best way to think of it is that the Genome Project gave us the machine language, the sort of nuts and bolts that your computer knows how to turn on the printer and knows how to read the input from the keyboard. But the non-coding DNA, when it's transcribed into these forms of microRNA, these are going to be the operating system. Much higher level, reprogrammable, a much better place to play around with. We have entered into a biological revolution that is unparalleled since the invention of the microscope. That's all I'm going to say. It's a wonderful, exciting time to be interested in science. Now, we're running low on time, so we'll spend a moment talking about dementia. We've alluded to that a little bit in this show. You've heard of amyloid. Research has shown that gum disease produces increased levels of amyloid in the brain. What people recently discovered is that that amyloid is being made in unhealthy, diseased gums and getting into the spinal cord. So people who had high levels, this is a study looking at 50 people, and they did spinal taps on them, and they measured how much amyloid beta they had. They also did gum swabs, looking at whether they had healthy or unhealthy microbiomes in their mouth. Well, people with good oral microbiomes had lower levels of amyloid in their central nervous system, And these proteins are linked, levels are linked to cognitive decline, and they had a lower chance of developing dementia. They don't know whether the good oral bacteria are eating the amyloid or are somehow binding it and preventing it from heading to the brain. It is, after all, a protein. But there's also some possibilities about other locations for bad proteins that might make their way to the brain and cause damage. So, floss, brush, but don't use Listerine. That's the take-home lesson from this episode of Ask Dr. Dawn. I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long. Stay healthy. Come back next week. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.